Vorträge, Interviews und Diskussionen aus dem Sonderforschungsbereich 1288 Praktiken des Vergleichens der Uni Bielefeld. Unvergleichliches Hören, die Audiothek. Der folgende Vortrag trägt den Titel New Perspectives on the Qualitative and Quantitative Study of the Nobel Prize in Literature. Professor Dr. Carlos Spörhase und Dr. Jürgen Snais analysieren darin, wie der Literaturnobelpreis zu einer neuen nationalen Konkurrenz geführt hat und ziehen Vergleiche zu den Medaillenrankings der Olympischen Spiele. Der Vortrag hat im Rahmen der SFB 1288 Ringvorlesung Nothing Compares to You am 14. Juli 2021 stattgefunden. Thematisiert wurden in der Ringvorlesung verschiedene Perspektiven auf Praktiken des Vergleichens, ihre Ursachen und Effekte von der Antike bis zur Gegenwart. Spörhase und Snais sind Projektleiter im SFB 1288 Teilprojekt F02 Null Meridian der Literatur. Der Literaturnobelpreis als globaler Vergleichsmaßstab.
We think of the Nobel Prize in Literature as an institution that has played a crucial role in the constitution of a global literary field in the 20th and 21st centuries. An institution that bundles diverse cultural practices in distinct communities of practice and serves to render literature comparable on a global scale.
We want to start out with a quote. In 2018, there was a gap year in Stockholm. No Nobel Prize in Literature was awarded because of a Me Too-related scandal. Maybe you all remember this. In this context, the famous literary critic Tim Parks wrote an article in the New York Times, essentially claiming that the real scandal of the Nobel Prize is the very existence of the prize itself. We think this assessment is interesting for several reasons, also because it stands in sharp contrast with how the Nobel Prize is viewed in recent scholarship on world literature. Pascal Casanova, for example, who has written a path-breaking book on this subject, places emphasis on the almost unanimous belief in the universality of the Nobel Prize for Literature. In our project, we are basically taking sides with Casanova, but we do think that the points made by Tim Parks are worth paying attention to. This is why we want to dwell for a moment on the analogy between literature and sports and the question of comparability.
In the early years of the Nobel Prize, it was repeatedly referred to as a world prize, Världspris, Weltpreis, in the Swedish Academy. By the same token, the newly elected Academy member Carl Bildt wrote in a letter to the Academy's permanent secretary in 1902 that this prize should have a universal character. This claim to universality, however, was and still is today seated within a conceptual framework characterized by a complex interplay of internationalization on the one hand and nationalization on the other. Adopting a term coined by Geert Somsen, we call this Olympic internationalism. Somsen uses this term in a somewhat different context. He is analyzing conceptions of internationality in the sciences and not in literature. In the 19th century, the scientific pursuit of knowledge began to be associated with patriotic values. This does not mean that the scientific claim to validity itself was being nationalized. Rather, scientific accomplishments were increasingly being presented in terms of national prestige. This scientific nationalism developed into an Olympic internationalism in the late 19th century as the international scientific community was increasingly institutionalized by means, for example, of international conferences and unions. So what's important here in our view is that internationalism and nationalism go hand in hand. Since national achievements had to be measured by an international standard, scientific internationalism was not a counterforce to nationalism, but effectively channeled and facilitated it. In this sense, science and sports work in similar ways around 1900 in terms of internationality. The complex interplay of internationalization and nationalization, which has already been outlined for the early years of the science prizes, must still be traced in a more detailed way for the history of the Nobel Prize in Literature. But we assume that the institutionalization of the Nobel Prize in Literature had a function quite similar to the institutionalization of the international scientific community. In the following, we would like to focus on just one cultural practice by which this interplay of internationalization and nationalization can be traced, and that is the compilation of lists and tables. This practice of comparing can be observed in a number of different contexts, starting with the Swedish Academy itself. In 1902, the Nobel Prize Committee started to record the number of nominated authors and also nominees sorted by nationality. And we want to ask, which function did these tables serve in the day-to-day work of the Nobel Prize Committee? It's interesting to observe how Alfred Nobel's last will and testament was received in the Swedish Academy. The idea of a new literature prize was by no means met only with enthusiasm. Some worried that this new and highly labor-intensive award would only distract from the Academy's designated tasks, that is, the cultivation of the Swedish language and literature. Or, as the longtime Academy member Carl Gustav Malmström puts it in 1897, that this organization would transform from a Swedish Academy into a, I quote, cosmopolitan literary tribunal. And there were heated discussions about this in the Swedish Academy, and different arguments were thrown back and forth. But interestingly, both opponents and advocates of the Nobel Prize agreed on one thing, that comparison would be the basic operation of this new task. So no one seems to have considered this act of comparing pointless or even impossible, as Tim Parks does today. The universal character of this World Prize now did not exclude thinking in terms of nationality. As early as 1902, a negative heuristic came into play that can be observed again and again in the following years. After giving the award to Sully Prudhomme in 1901, it could not be awarded again to a Frenchman. This would undermine this universal character. Within the Academy, the members spoke of a successive circulation in different nations. Even if one knew practically nothing about what was discussed in the Nobel Prize Committee in Stockholm, this successive circulation of the Nobel Prize was quickly recognized in the international press, and the Academy, in turn, was paying close attention to the international mass media coverage. The cultural practice of table making is quite common during this period in different contexts. Consider, for example, the medal table of the Olympic Games. In the Nobel Prize Committee's work, the table takes on a precise function. It does not only record the national distribution of nominated authors and nominees, but also feeds into this negative heuristic that determines future awards, in the sense that the literature prize cannot be awarded to the same nation over and over again. This heuristic seems to be based on the assumption that there exists a certain number of national literatures of equal value, whose achievements should all be taken into account sooner or later. So the lists and tables kept by the Swedish Academy are grounded in a complex system of presuppositions that in practice and without adherence to the statutes guide future decision-making. Culture appears as a universal category that allows for comparison between individual events and between individual value hierarchies, the Theatrum Comparationis being in this case cultural achievement. The further conclusions drawn from this national distribution of the Nobel Prizes rest not only on the assumption that the prizes have been awarded justly, which testifies to a considerable collective belief in the institution. They also rest on the assumption that literary works, for example, are in fact firmly anchored in a certain culture. So in this sense, we can reply to Tim Parks. The notion of literature being something culturally unique and intimately tied to its cultural origins does not seem to stand in the way of comparability, but rather to make a comparison attractive in the first place.
We can also observe a fascination with Nobel Prize comparisons and tables in academia. Books Abroad, for example, an American journal founded in 1927, has on numerous occasions conducted surveys and subsequently published extensive discussions on the Nobel Prize. This table entails, again, sorted by nationality, the winners and non-winners judged worthy of the Nobel Prizes by roughly 350 respondents from academia. So the surveys in Books Abroad, especially this one from 1951, seem to have been followed closely by the Swedish Academy. This seems to be another example of the second order observation, similar to the Academy's observation of the international mass media coverage. In addition to the press, literary scholarship is recognized by the Swedish Academy as a relevant voice and closely observed, potentially with consequences for its own comparative evaluation and awarding practices. Several of the non-winners judged worthy in books abroad in 1951, so in the table that you are looking at right now, did actually win in the following years. Later surveys of books abroad are interesting for different reasons. Again, the main theme in these issues is the comparison of prize-winning authors with those who have remained empty-handed. But what is new here is that it combines normative aesthetic evaluation with a reflection on the Nobel Prize as a social and historical phenomenon and as a product of the media. So when one of the contributors writes that the international competition for the gold medal of the Nobel Prize in Literature is as strong as the sporting rivalry for the gold medal at the Olympic Games, the analogy makes it very clear that the Nobel Prize in Literature, from the perspective of many observers, is never awarded simply to individuals, to individual authors, but also to geographical, political, cultural, and linguistic contexts of their origin. To the extent that the Nobel Prize within the framework of an Olympic internationalism cannot avoid doing more and very different things than simply honoring individual authors, it seems different from other literature prizes. Nobel Prize tables are, in our view, not merely an accessory. The tables we have presented to you today may seem somewhat far from literature, but that is precisely their point. These tables and lists allow us to trace the mechanisms of comparing that have been attention-defining for different actors involved with the Nobel Prize in Literature. We echo here a distinction made by literary historian Francesca Orsini, who differentiates between thick and thin knowledge with regard to the circulation of world literature. Orsini, who has primarily worked on Asian, especially Indian literatures, points to the fact that in many cases, not only substantial knowledge, but also superficial familiarity can shape the perception as well as the everyday dealings with world literature. So as far as the Nobel Prize goes, the knowledge involved is as thin as it comes. If one only learns the names of the laureates and a few other facts, such as their nationality, through the press, but has not read a single text and perhaps never will. But in return, this thin form of knowledge travels very fast. So the tables we have discussed show that the global circulation of this thin knowledge has played a significant and, we think, decisive role in making the Nobel Prize in Literature a world prize in the 20th and 21st century.
Unvergleichliches Hören. Wie vergleichen wir? Was passiert, wenn wir vergleichen? Entdecke die Vielfalt der Vergleichspraktiken. Vorträge, Interviews und Diskussionen aus dem Sonderforschungsbereich 1288 Praktiken des Vergleichens der Uni Bielefeld. Unvergleichliches Hören, die Audiothek.